hey, I'm Nevin and I'm cooking up a podcast. Each week, I'm talking with people about food and cooking, sharing some recipes and going on some adventures. This week, I'm talking about real and natural wines with David Mitchell, the owner of Mies Wines. All right. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Cooking Up a Podcast. If you haven't checked out the website, please check out the website, nevintaylorcooks.com. I'm sharing recipes and posting videos up on YouTube every single week. New stuff coming out all the time. But this week, I'm talking with David Mitchell, very passionate about wine. And I am not super educated about wine. I like drinking wine. Wine is cool. I like natural wines. I like wines that are maybe a little bit more, have a little bit more character than the like foofy, traditional, ooh, I like wine, you know, swirl it around and sniff it type of stuff. But, you know, wine has a story. Wine has a personality. There's a whole world of stuff in there. And David Mitchell helps me learn and explains a few things to me, and hopefully this is the beginning of some more things to come with David Mitchell. He gives some suggestions on wine and that sort of thing, and yeah, maybe we'll figure out some stuff to do. We're gonna go on some trips, we're gonna go on some adventures. He's gonna be a little wine go-to guy on here, hopefully, so we'll hear from him again soon. Yeah, so here we go. This is me and David Mitchell.
I'm David Mitchell and own a very small importing and wine distribution company, Mies, M-I-S-E. So April of 2018 was our sixth year business. Before that, I worked, had the pleasure, lucky enough to work for one of the real iconic small import companies in Massachusetts, Violette Imports, for Richard Kazarian at Violette Imports, who, you know, gave me the chance and the freedom to do a lot of different things over a decade or more of working with him, and really got to know Boston and the wine scene here and the culture. And I just owe him a lot for what he meant to me and what continues to mean for me. 6 years, April was our 6 year anniversary, and I started the company with my colleague and partner Jackson, who worked with me at Violette. And prior to that, I got in the wine business in California. So I moved here from California right before the crazy Y2K millennial period. I was had got to California after being in university in Virginia on the East Coast, and I realized after doing a few years in the Navy, as much as I loved certain parts of it, I was not going to make a career out of it. And I spent a few summers figuring out what I wanted to do as soon as I could get out. And I started working at some wine shops in downtown San Diego where I was stationed. Some really iconic wine shops, and got to see the industry kind of as a consumer and spend some time figuring it out and figuring out what my role could be in it. I guess my history in the business has seen it from the ground up, from so the really commercial side all the way up into artisanal wine, and most recently here in New England, understanding what I think artisanal wine and good quality wine is all about, and what wine means to me and how it can be appreciated, and what's its cultural reference point and whatnot. And so for us, that really means wines that are made by hand, meaning that everything is not just physically vineyards are worked by hand, but harvested by hand. Natural wine, meaning wine that's fermented with wild yeast, you know, natural yeasts, and wine with the most minimal amount of handling. So on one side of the spectrum, we have a portfolio where wines are made by hand and no sulfites are added. And it's completely like a very beautiful, wild experience, very pure. And then we have some wines that are, you know, a couple steps down from there, but are moving in that direction. Real wine, quality wine, artisanal wine is being made in every state. And I think there's sort of a renaissance that's happening now for domestic wine in places that have nothing to do with California, you know, any other state. And almost in every region of the country, you see really good quality wine being made, whether it's Vermont, Long Island, Texas, Minnesota, Utah, mm-hmm. Maryland. Yeah. So it's really exciting.
When you were in the Navy and you first got those like retail wine jobs, like what was it?
Well, in college, I was a history major, and probably because I wanted to do a lot of different things and I didn't really know what I wanted to do all at the same time. I think wine is a cultural tie-in for sort of history, geology. It's a product that's made by human beings for human beings. Yeah, I was just curious about the product. You know, it's got this cork closure and you have to have the strange like corkscrew to open it. And there's something about it that's really sort of out of the 19th century in a world that's like, you know, technology and iron and fast cars. And, you know, I mean, totally. You find yourself in your 20s, it's not a lot of things like a bottle of wine that, besides the fact it's alcohol and, you know, it gets you all loopy and whatnot.
Your general interest or the first thing that kind of started was being a history major and the cultural connections and kind of like the depth that goes into producing something like wine, which we've talked a lot about before in, you know, specifically New England. But then, you know, with your background in wine, like what are some of those, I guess, like cultural expressions or like some of that deep history type stuff that like really kind of like made it the light bulb go off in your head maybe?
Oh, I mean, it's you know, when you have a chance to travel to a wine region and meet a family who's been, you know, multi-generations farming the same place. I think in the modern world, because the U.S., we're such a mobile society and more mobile all the time. And we can't even, you know, most people don't even, they buy a house, they don't even live in it for more than a few years before they sell and move to another house. And just think of a family that's tied to a piece of land, the same piece of land for multi-generations, you know, and that day to day, week to week, year to year exchange that happens between different generations of a family regarding wine or just in life is just pretty amazing. So those are really special sort of situations when you can see those and be exposed to them. But then, being a history major, you know, recently I've been fascinated because 2018, you know, this November will be the signing of the armistice, the end of World War I. And so in 2014, and since 2014, there's been a lot of books about the history of World War I. A lot of these, our veterans have died a long time ago, who veterans from World War I, but and it's not too far from many wine regions in France. You know, there were a lot of really horrible battles that were fought, and we can't really understand like the kind of gross industrialization of warfare. You know, when you hear about statistics, like I read that 8 million horses died in World War I, we can't understand today what, they can't wrap our head around that. And so when you go to these wine regions where, you know, the lines were moving back and forth and they were occupied versus being liberated, and you had these armies moving through them, and they made wine through that experience and before it and after it, and what that meant for the people that came back from the war, if they were lucky enough to come back, and what that meant for the surrounding area where you might have unexploded shells for 40, 50 years being still in the vineyards they were found. And, you know, occasionally those kinds of things are just, you know, interwoven that, you know, in this country we can't sort of understand, you know. And we're sitting here in the greater Boston area, which has been importing wine from Burgundy and Bordeaux, just as an example, for hundreds of years. And so throughout conflicts and wars, and whether they're on this side of the hemisphere or on that side of the hemisphere, like, it's just amazing to me that, you know, wine is a constant in some ways, you know. It's a human endeavor. It cuts through tragedy and loss and good times and bad. And also, I think anyone who really likes wine has this story of a memorable bottle of wine that they can, and they remember where they are, who they're with, when they had it. And because when you know, wine is tied to memory. And so not just the history and culture, that side of memory, but also, you know, our emotions that come from memory. It's like a moment in time. It's almost like when you listen to a music album and you have that amazing experience with an album. The reason it's called an album is because it's, those songs are kind of locked in time, you know. And it's the food that goes with it. You know, you remember what restaurant you had and what you ordered. That whole, all those things working together. There's something that happens. They're all in your senses that come together, and it's locked emotionally in this space in time. And even if you recreate it, it could never be exactly the as meaningful or as special.
I didn't see the World War One thing coming. That was
it's quite amazing, the history and wine being wrapped up in there. And you know, you'd say World War II as well, but I think there's just so much more written about World War II. It's more closer to our U.S. consciousness, and we're so far removed from World War I because it was a mostly, you know, European conflict. The Americans were involved until like the last year of the war. So.
All right, let's talk. I like want to go maybe a little bit deeper on natural wine or real wines or whatever the terminology is that you want to use. But
sure. So when we started the company, we had this sort of motto, the saying, you know, the art mise is the art and joy of real wine. So I like to use the term real wine. Natural wine is a very popular term right now at the moment. For me, wine has to be made from properly grown grapes. And for a long time, that term had to properly grown meant the way they looked, growing as many, you know, just having as much yield as possible. But it's deeper than that because, you know, we all understand now that you have to respect the land, has to be grown the right way. So growing grapes organically or biodynamically, quote unquote, naturally, is the least common denominator for how you make like real wine or good wine. Natural wine is one of these words that for me doesn't tell the consumer a lot. I think it's a really vague term, and so you have a lot of people latching onto it. You know, loosely means, you know, the wines with the least amount of additives or zero additives possible. So it's a trendy word to use natural wine now, but I think for some people it's really hard for them to wrap their mind around. I like the term real wine for me. That means that from my standpoint, my standard is wine comes from grapes and it's shepherded along a production fermentation process into wine. Now, some people with multi-generations of history behind them and a lot of experience can make wine with zero or very low additives. But for some people in regions where you don't have that history, they're working their way towards that. So I don't have one standard necessarily for everybody. What's for me personally most important is that the grapes are grown the right way and that a winemaker is every year working to use the least amount of technology and manipulation and additives possible. So everyone's kind of on a process. You know, it's a bit like a musician. You know, when you start out making music, you might have a hit song, but you're always pushing, you got to be pushing yourself to like a new frontier of making the best art form possible. And wine is not made, does not make itself. I think we live in a kind of a really interesting wine nexus right now where you have one size spectrum. People, they only want to deal with wines without any sulfites added. And so they're very virulent about that. And I completely respect that we have some of those growers and some of those wines in our portfolio, but I'm not sure that's sort of always possible for everybody because at the end of the day, you know, producers want to sell their wine. And if no one likes the wine or if there's problems with it, you make a mistake. And you can live with that mistake all year long. You have to be able to make a product that's stable, that can be able to ship, that people resonates with people, that's delicious. I mean, how do you describe the taste of delicious? You kind of know it when you see it. And for everybody, there's kind of like a range of what delicious is.
Wine lists and stuff, like I have no idea. Like I don't even know what I know what the year is, but like other than that, there's so much stuff.
Right.
Like,
well, for me, I get back to like clothing or art. Like it's the same way for music. It's such an amazing time. There's types of music right now that, you know, there's a range of music, you know, you never saw this range before. Wine is finally put on that kind of level, you know, which I think is some ways for the consumer. There's, you can find whatever you want out there. You just got to know how to find it.
A lot of the like exclusivity of it has been broken away.
Completely been broken away because not only we don't have red and white and rosé, now we have fizzy, we have pink and fizzy, we have white and fizzy, we have red and fizzy, we have sweet and dry and all these. So I think for the first time ever, if you like a wine a certain way, there's wine for you out there.
Yeah.
You know,
I like how you just said that. That's to me, like, that's what I like. And maybe, you know, where my headspace usually is like, I know what flavors I like, or I know, like, you know, white and fizzy and light. Like, I like that. But, like, what that means in a lot of ways.
And don't get me wrong, I mean, there's challenges to that because as we start talking about these wines from Maryland, all Westminster wines in a can, wine is a visual product and people are drawn to the way the wine looks and tastes and the way the visual appeal of it. So it's a bit dangerous too, because all those things get away from what we're trying to tell people about, which is most important, which is how the wine is made.
Right.
You know, for us, we have to have wines that look good and taste good. That's got to be part of the package, no matter what. That's number one. But let's peel back that first layer of onion and say, whatever you put in your body that you buy from us, like, these aren't poisonous wines. These are wines that are, you know, they're real wine. And that's the hardest thing about wine. I mean, honestly, we live in visual world, and then when you get the wine open, the way it tastes, but we're trying to beat this drum of like, the grapes are grown the right way, and they're from this farmer, and they're from this place, and this is why it tastes the way it does. Yeah. You know, the USDA has like 5 pages of additives you can put into wine, and they're not poisons. They're just like thickers and fillers and color agents and all these things that have nothing to do with grapes. And we just want wine that says grapes, you might have a little preservative in there, you know, sulfites or whatever, if you need it, because it's from halfway around the world. But yeah.
Specifically, what are sulfites and what do they do to the wine?
Yeah, sulfur. So sulfur has been used since Roman times as a preservative to help a wine be more stable as it transports, whether it was in clay jars or in oak barrels or whatever. So it helps the wine from oxidizing, especially you're talking about like a white wine. And so it's been used in small amounts. I mean, sulfur is on the periodic table of elements, so it's a natural compound, but sulfites and most of the sulfur used in winemaking is also from the it's one of the derivatives of petroleum refineries. You know, there is this belief that you can get volcanic sulfur, which your body can understand and break down way more easily. It's almost like vitamins, you know, there's locally occurring organic compounds and vitamins, and then there's the stuff that is synthetic vitamins, and when you go to the store, you have to really know what you're getting, because your body can metabolize them differently. So it's not so much about, in my mind, and about like whether sulfites are good or bad. It's more like, you know, a little goes a long way, and if a winemaker is very careful using sulfites to make sure a wine is stable, it's not a poison. There are people who don't want to add anything to their wines, and I completely respect, and you know, if they can do that, that's great. The wine has to come after around the world. Just like in the political spectrum, there are people who are really adamant that, you know, this is the only way and this is what's right and anything else, but this is wrong. And so, you know, I'm not getting wrapped up in the right and wrong. I want to believe in someone who's passionate about what they're doing, who's growing grapes the right way and is following their consciousness. People who are experimenting with it, and more likely what you see is people who are conscious, who are trying to make wine without sulfites, are reducing the amount and comfortable using a hundredth of what they might have used or what their previous generation had used. And then some years they can have wines without sulfites. It depends. I mean, the weather's so wacky or climate's so wacky. Everything's changing every year. Some years the grapes have more natural acidity and some years they don't. Some vintages of wines you drink early and young, and some are built to age and they have that structure. So most of the growers we work with, most growers who are thinking about minimal intervention, are using the lunar calendar to bottle. So there's a, you know, full moon, and it's usually done seasonally. It's almost like, think of harvest moon kind of a concept. You know, when the pressure is such that you're gonna extract the most amount of, least amount of solid material in the bottling, you know, so you can bottle with the least amount of intervention, and you're, all the solids settled on the bottom, and it all has to do with like the pressure and the, you know. So most of these growers, with that in mind, you know, bottle certain times of the year, and they'll sometimes even tell you like, the wine was just bottled, but it's only going to get better. So you wait for another season to come around. So you bring it in the middle of summer, but it's the end of the summer thing that happens when you go into fall and the weather finally goes from being warmish to more coolish, and you retaste that wine again. You're like, oh, the wine is just spot on. It's a smoke show. It's just really at its best right now. Wow. It was good before, but it's just better, you know?
And then even more like, time than that, like
it's more expressive aromatics when you smell the glass. Like, oh my God.
Six months, right? From.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's, yeah.
But then what about
that first year in the bottle, because some producers will bottle it and hold on to it before they release it. You know, it just depends. Each region, each kind of wine, the history, they all have their own, you know, way of doing things. But yeah. Yeah. You know, and again, a great example is rosé. Like most people, we're going into warm weather here, and people are going to be pasty white skin and flip flops and shorts all over Boston. But and they want to drink rosé. But the reality is, most of these the real rosés that are bottled in April now, or you know, anytime from end of March to through April, are going to be at their best like in August, and most of them will be long gone and drunk and bottles emptied and on their way to recycling centers. The average span of a life of a bottle of wine is 45 minutes from the time of purchase. If you combine retail and restaurant experiences, average them together, like from a wine is ordered in a restaurant, it's drunk right away. Yeah. From a retail, it's like 45 minutes.
I've never really thought about wine as a seasonal endeavor.
The harvest happens anywhere from, depending on every, there's a fluctuation from September, October, maybe some cool regions into end of October. Fermentation's going to get you into November, middle of November, December. You want to go through a period of settling. There's a primary fermentation, secondary fermentation, and then you have some settling of solid material falling through. You need cold winter temperatures to do that. So maybe some growers used to fling open their doors in the cellar to have the cold air come in the winter to settle the tanks down. And then you bottle the basic.
So the bottling won't happen until the spring.
Yeah, after the spring.
Then it goes in the bottle in the spring.
And it's all shook up. You need a period of the wine to kind of sit and, you know, come into its own. Yeah. But the red wines, after they were finished in the spring, probably went into barrel, or end of winter went into barrel, and they're racked off from one barrel to another. And they would go through a period of aging in barrel to help them soften and round out, you know, and go through that cellar treatment, then bottle at the end of the summer or something like that. Not winemaker, but a vigneron would look at Noah's vineyards, and this is where you have that amazing cumulative knowledge of generations. And he's learned from his father or their parents or grandparents that this soil on this hill, like the vines, usually the best vines come from this part. They ripen later, but that's the really good stuff. Or he knows the difference between young vines and old vines, or he knows where certain parcels are never, most of the time, don't ripen the right way. Or over the course of a growing season, watching them, knowing that what's happening from a storm, hail, whatever, where there's some damage, and we should pick this early and young because it's probably not going to sit through the end of fall and be some of our best quality fruit. So that's stuff we can make rosé from, press off and rosé. This stuff you can go into some sort of a basic entry-level light red blend. And then where the best quality grapes are, they're going to be long-lived, and the most long-lived wines in barrels or cellars or tanks or casks or, you know.
What about these old Westminster people? They got some cool stuff going on.
Yeah, kind of a breath of fresh air. So the Baker family, this is Andrew Baker and his two sisters, reached out to me last fall and just out of the blue and said, hey, we like some of the other producers you work with in the U.S. that we know, whose wines we like, and Oregon and these wines from Long Island that Regan Meador makes and now is making in Texas. And, we want to talk to you about our winery. And so they're a family who, and these brother and two sisters inherited this farm that had been growing as a tree farm. And they, after college and going their separate ways and different specialties, came together and said, how can we, what can we start here that we're passionate about, that we want to do? And they wanted to give winemaking a shot. They weren't the first, and they saw the potential of the greater Maryland area to be, a place you could grow some pretty phenomenal grapes. And there's definitely a history of it. If you go back hundreds of years of growing grapes in Maryland, colonial period and whatnot. And then, about a month after that, Andrew said, he reached out to me and said, I have this new project I want to tell you about. And he showed me this, images of the wine in a can. I was just, my first inclination was a whole bunch of question marks and what's going on. And then we had a couple discussions about it. And then we had a chance to try the wines. They started the first round of canning last fall. And every time I tasted them, every time I met him and we came up, it was clear that they weren't doing it as a fad. They really wanted to get, they saw what's happened with beer and having small amounts of really high quality beers that were really minimally handled. Some of these were no preservatives, and so they were delicate in a can. And they thought, well, if they can do that with beer that's carbonated, we can do this with wine. And I think they were hell bent on, because they were young, they're young, is not being afraid of having people tell them they couldn't do it. And they're doing on such a limited scale that they feared, nothing venture, nothing gain. If it doesn't work out, what do we have to lose? It's a new venture for us. We just started with them this spring, but the hardest part we have is that the visual appeal of the packaging is pretty phenomenal. They stand out. They really nailed it from a design standpoint, which is great for business. But what's in the can is really good quality wine. They're all unfiltered wines. Off dry white, dry white, and two rosés.
What does that mean, unfiltered?
In some ways, sulfites, and talking about sulfites is like the biggest buzzword, but it's been used since the Roman era. But when you talk about really real wine and wine that's made artisanally, unfiltered wines mean you haven't passed it through some membrane filter, so you haven't pulled out solid materials that are attached to other sort of compounds. So when you hold up a clear glass bottle of white wine and it's just pristine, clear, sort of white, looks like water, that usually result of something that's, been done to the
manipulation.
So you can use machines, varying degrees of membranes, going down to microns and, one micron and even smaller than that. So it's basically like pushing, like through osmosis, pushing the wine through like a something that a million times more dense than a coffee filter, you know? So what you're pulling out is not just solid material, visually solid, but other compounds attracted to it, which means that the wine is clean. It's quote unquote sterilized. So you don't have to worry about anything happening to it, but also means that over time that wine's going to fall apart because you've robbed it of materials that help it protect itself and age.
And add flavor, I'm sure.
And add flavor. Yeah. Character. So for the most part, through temperature, you can have a wine kind of be cold stabilized and you can have it also be unfiltered. So you can find a way of not having like thick, cloudy, floaty things happening in it. When I talk about old Westminster cans, they are just, when you pour the wine in a clear glass, you can see there's just a tiny hint of faint cloudiness, but it just means the wine is unadulterated. It's not manipulated. It's not mass commodity. It's not a mass commodity that is bought and sold like, you know, you might get from California or something like that at that price range. And there, so all these grapes are, they're grown in Maryland and they're grown sustainably. Drew was the first person. He's great about saying we're not certified organic, but we're really trying hard to do it. It's a very wet climate for growing grapes. And so we're getting very close, but we can't legally be called, get certified organic viticulture yet, but they're like on the verge of doing it. And he feels like it's going to be the next, they're doing experimentations every year all the time. And they're using, you know, herbal sprays and whatnot. They're zeroing down. It's going to be there, but they just feel like they can't legally say that yet. And that's just goes to how honest they are about every step of the process. And I want to support people like that who are working hard to get in that way, because they could be certified organic and make vinegar. And I'm not selling vinegar. I've got to sell good wine. You know, we have had, as a small company, a little bit of experience with selling wines that don't come in a glass bottle with a cork closure. People think that like a screw cap is, or some beer cap is kind of avant-garde. But when you start getting into the numbers and the economics of the glass and the cork and what it all means, you realize how much waste there is in the wine world. And so part of the reason why we feel good about selling these alternative forms of packaging is that if the wine in each package is good quality wine, then, and all you're trying to do is to get people to visually deal with a different form of enclosure or packaging. And what's great is, as the millennial generation gets to be of more wine drinking legal age, they don't care. They just don't care about that. Just like, you know, they're so adamant about certain things. They're just adamant about like, if it tastes good and if, and they're visually appealing, they actually go towards that kind of stuff. So it's liberating because I'm not of that generation. It's liberating for me to see those kinds of customers, because we run into situations where buyers of my age or older will be anti wine X or wine Y because it's in an alternative form of packaging, but they somehow, if they bring it in a store and give it a shot, like their customers are running towards it and then they have to reorder it. It opens their mind that way. It's almost like 10, 15 years ago when people of my generation were, you know, adamant about wanting to go to Whole Foods because they felt like there's just better quality stuff there.
I guess we could touch on cider really quick. To me, it's like that's the New England expression of all of these sort of things, which recently is now starting to get some stuff. And I've found recently as a thing to be doing, but, it seems like, you know, that whole process, it's like the same process basically, but like with a different fruit and a different end product. But like, it's, I don't know, there's like some sort of a connection that I feel to it of the like, you know, people in France feel to grapes.
So people are definitely, I mean, the people planting grapes and the amount of wineries in New England is growing, but just like planting orchards, it takes time for these to come in. So it takes a lot of capital to plant an orchard.
Potentially generations even too, to really kind of.
Exactly. And so, you know, there are a couple of things you can experiment with different types of trees, whatever, but it takes a long time for an industry like cider to the orchards to come up from ground up. It takes, it can be like a generation, you know? So some of the things that have happened the last 10 years, we're going to start feeling in the next 5 or 7, but there's stuff coming online sort of all the time. And so you have this combination of something that takes a lot of time, capital intensive. And from a production standpoint, there's a whole lost history of cider in this part of the world. This was like a huge cider. I mean, you know, the New England countryside is littered with apple trees that are now in the middle of the forest because they mark people's property. You know, farmers made their own cider at home. It was this self-sufficient kind of product. They might have bought something distilled here or there in the local pub or gone to a pub for a beer, but you know, they made their own cider because why buy something when you can make it? You know, it's that thrifty New England spirit. But they had to mark their property by, you know, planting these apple trees. You couldn't clear forest for land unless you were legally, you had to plant apple trees to mark your property. So this history of what kind of apples make the best kind of cider, what kind of cider is the style of New England, what kind of ciders you drink at certain times of the year, because you can have ciders that are meant to be drunk young and some that are best for aging, and all and everything in between. Is this was lost. Prohibition, we just lost everything during Prohibition. We lost a generation of people who had that history and knew how to make those products and had done it for generations and whatnot. So it's going to take a long time to come back, but I'm excited about all the people who are running headlong into it.
Yeah. Do you think it could become, I mean, obviously not size and girth of wine, but could become more prevalent in the variety, I guess, as like one, like, I mean, all of the stuff that's here, you know what I mean? Like something.
There's so many varieties of apples that most people have no clue about. I mean, there are a few people in New England who still propagate the kinds of trees, the types of varieties of apples that you can make amazing cider with. But, you know, there's also phenomenal eating apples. I mean, we also forget that this part of the world, you grew a variety of apples because you were eating apples up until May or June. I mean, blueberries and whatnot, you know, you couldn't find those wild until, I mean, now, you know, wild, not high bush, but, you know, blueberries until a certain time of the year. And so there were apples planted expressly so a farm could have fresh fruit to eat to get you through New England spring, in quotation marks, you know, which is not March, it's May, you know. So, you know, I mean, we have that lost that history too, where now we go in the grocery store, three or four types of apples, and we expect them year round. They come from Washington or, you know, somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. And we've just lost that whole history. But some apples that are, you cannot eat, they're so hard and high in acid when they're picked in September, October, are absolutely phenomenal come March or April. And they have layered complexity to them. And then to cook with some, you can cook with them early or eat with them late, you know? And so it's just more than just cider. It's all history, it's hundreds of years, thousands of years of like propagating, apple trees, which I think a lot of stuff has been lost. So I'd be looking forward to the day when people have some sort of device that someone smarter than me has concocted so that, you know, a household can buy a bushel or two and in the winter and store them in some device that helps keep them gas from, you know, from aging and spoiling so they can have fresh fruit that's locally grown year round and to taste what that fruit is like and how as it softens, it gets sweeter and, you know, have a family understand that relationship and be tied to that relationship because New England can't grow as many apples. We're not going to feed the world. We're not going to feed North America. You can grow way more apples in the Midwest and out west on the West Coast in terms of volume. But we can grow a high quality apple and we can grow a range of apples and storage apples to get us through winter. And then when you overlay that with cider, I mean, it's just so many varieties of amazing cider varieties that we could bring back into a beverage that was not for, you know, nationwide consumption, but for consumption New England, you know? So in the same way that people are talking about natural wine, you can make ciders that way too. Unfiltered, you know, cloudy, no sulfites added, that can be, you know, beautiful and rich and tannic and high in acid and can have with hard cheeses and have with serious food, you know, pork chops and whatnot and did. And I'd love to see that sort of come back, you know, but it's going to take some time. I'm not sure the average consumer knows what those ciders taste like. They can't be flavored, you know, they can't be like additive or flavored or dry hopped or, you know, mix of blueberry, you know, extract or whatever. There's got to be a taste of apples. Yeah. Yeah. No one knows what a cider's like that's been in cask and it's aged for 5 years in the bottle. No one knows what that's like. But once upon a time, they did.
Spring's coming. Summer's not far behind. Like, what are you excited about to drink or to have around the table right now?
I would say across the board, you know, rosé is very fashionable now, but I think that we're finally getting to the point where really good white wine can be consumed in the same, where people consider it the same par with sort of red wine. And I'm not trying to tell people it has to look this way or taste this way, but I mean, making red wine is sort of easy. Once you've done it once or twice, it's pretty straightforward. Making white wine, good quality, world-class white wine that can age is really hard to do. So I'm actually looking forward to this summer and having some really great white wines that go with a variety of foods that you don't serve ice cold, that you can drink, have the bottle open over a couple of days, that make you hungry. You have a sip of and they make you hungry, you know, and putting down, I mean, New England summer is so fleeting. We have winter all, you know, red wine all winter long. It's nice to have a few months where you just can be focused on white wines and have them with, you know, whatever, hard cheeses and meats or, you know, serious stuff. So,
yeah. So plug me on some, like either a place, a variety, a thing, a producer, like what's a thing like that I can go to the store right now and just maybe I wouldn't be able to find something that you have or distribute, but like something that I could go be like, this is maybe an expression of the thing that.
So people associate white wine being like floral and fruity. And I think that some of the best white wines coming from either Loire Valley, Chenin Blanc, or in certain parts of Italy. I've been really taken the last couple of years with Verdicchio. Verdicchio is a white variety of grape that's grown on the East Coast, central East Coast of Italy. And the wine can be, you know, sweet, aromatic, but I mean, not sweet, fruity, but not like sugary sweet, but salty and minerally. It can reward patients. It like gets your appetite going. You know, you can have it with fish. You can have the vegetables. You can have it with, you know, white meats. You can have it with terrines. You can have it with cheese. It's like kind of a, you know, it can go with so many different types of things.
Like summertime.
Exactly.
Cookout outside.
Exactly.
Sitting on the patio.
Exactly. Yeah. And it can, you can have a glass, you can finish a bottle, you can have it over a couple days, you know. Yeah. I always tell people don't put it in the fridge. Don't put it ice cold in the fridge. You know, you want it kind of cool, but not cool to the touch, but not ice cold.
So take, like, store it out or store it in the fridge and take it out?
Keep it in the fridge if you just bought it and you're going to have it that night, but bring it out ahead of time.
Yeah,
let it warm up a bit.
Sit for a few.
Pull the cork and, you know, pour yourself a glass. It'll get that temperature going a bit more. And yeah.
Like, what are some goals or visions or stuff that you have or like plans down the road or anything for Mies and wine or?
More of the same, continued growth, I would say, throughout Massachusetts. There's just an amazing state of hills and dales and small nooks and crannies of towns of different sizes. And it's a very old part of the country. So in every of these nooks and crannies, there's people who care about wine and good wine. And there's a huge farming history in this state. So we want to continue to grow and expand to, you know, from the tip of Cape Cod all the way out to the western edge of the Berkshires and everywhere in between. But we also want to get more of those people who maybe have tried one of our wines, but don't know us as a company, to kind of get to be known as that kind of go-to local company and get known for maybe not necessarily what's on the front of the label all the time, because that might change over the course of a year. But if they see that back label and they trust that Mies name, that they'll keep going to it no matter what, if it's a Tetra Pak, a can, a glass bottle, whatever. The history of wine in this state, in this Commonwealth, is a rich pageant of amazing companies and importers who we're following the footsteps in. I just want us to be one of the great small little companies that gets known.
What's the last memorable food thing that someone else has cooked for you? Could be a restaurant, could be at someone's home, but the last thing that pops in your mind is a memorable food experience.
We're in this transition time of the year, so sometimes, and I'm a firm believer in, I cook at home all the time, but I don't like to do fancy stuff. So I think ingredients, especially when they're fresh, should kind of speak for themselves. And even though it hasn't happened this year, I'm so excited about asparagus season, which we're just on the verge of hitting here. So I would just encourage people, if you eat asparagus, first of all, don't eat it in the wintertime. But if you eat and you're excited about asparagus season coming up, go to a farm, get it as fresh out of the farm and eat it raw. Like, that is for me like just an amazing experience. When, if you have a chance to pick it yourself or to see someone, no one's picked that morning, and eat it raw, it can be so sweet, and it changes so much in 24 hours. It's like a whole different vegetable after 24 hours. So I'm excited to see asparagus and peas in New England because they're like that first green things that we're going to see here, you know, and other greens as well.
Yeah. So last year or in years past,
where
have you
gotten? Yeah, so my partner Jenny's family has this farm in Cohasset, and they have a little bit of asparagus there, and picking it and eating it right in the field is just such a treat. It's just, it makes getting through winter worth it. You're just like, it's like the beginning of warm weather, of growing season again.
What is a memorable food from growing up?
My grandmother, my mother's mother, is a really good cook. So she used to make amazing food. So when we would get together as a family or Sunday meals, you know, and going over to their house, she would just be cooking so many sort of dishes that were, I just remember eating for hours, you know, long after meals, eating for hours. And So there's a lot of things wrapped up sort of in there. You know, my mom's side of the family, was Arabic. So a lot of his dishes had, you know, I grew up with things like hummus and tabbouleh, fresh made, you know, after someone's been sitting over chopping parsley and working in a food processor all day, and kibbeh things that, you know, meals that take time, a lot of time, that someone who works in a restaurant can understand, you know, not running home, putting a few things together.
It's a day.
And then you savor them for hours, you know, because just, you know, course after course and so many of them. So just meals that were over, but then somehow I was able to go back and get a thirds or a fourth and come back an hour later and keep crazy and eating.
Oh man, that's great. Yeah. That's super awesome. What is the most or recently memorable last thing that you've cooked either for yourself or for other people?
Yeah. Well, I think we might've discussed this as well. Like I've been taken with home baking for the last few years. So I've been baking my own sourdough bread at home. So actually just over the weekend had probably a loaf that was very memorable. It was probably one of my top whole wheat loaves. Yeah. Experimenting of like high percentage of whole wheat flour. So this was like 40% whole wheat flour with like a 36 hour ferment, you know, soup to nuts and high hydration level. So they're from grains. I've been a member for a couple of years of this grain CSA. So there was whole wheat from growing here in central Massachusetts. And the flavor, you know, and I cut after it cooled and I cut into the loaf was just like, you just felt like it was the kind of bread you could see someone having 100 years ago, 200 years ago. And so it's a cultural reference point, you know. You could have breakfast, you got it for lunch. I just found myself slicing slice after slice after slice. And it was, you know, it's so toothsome, it's so nourishing. Like it's a food unto itself, but whether you have a cheese or butter or olive oil or whatever, you know.
It's perfect.
Yeah, exactly.
David Mitchell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Nevin.
Thanks for showing
me. This has been fun. Let's do this again.
Yeah, absolutely. There you have it. Thanks, David Mitchell. That was a really fun conversation. Learned a lot about wine and cider and all sorts of stuff like that. Made my first batch of cider this last fall and gearing up for a larger cider adventure this fall. Tons of fun stuff going on for sure. For the recipe this week, I am sharing malfatti with tomatoes and nettles. Went out and got some nettles. They're popping up everywhere. It's springtime. This recipe was inspired by Connie Green and Ignacios Matos. They're super cool. Ignacios in the new Bon Appetit feature, going to the Italian countryside. Super next level. Bringing a bunch of friends, cooking all the time, drinking Aperol spritzes. So I tried to tap into a little bit of that. And Connie Green, in her book, The Wild Table, she has a recipe for malfatti with nettles. So I kind of, you know, just riffed on both of those and came out really good. So, new recipe up on nevintaylorcooks.com, new video recipe up on my YouTube channel. Check it out. And I have been going crazy getting a ton of more interviews going. I have a bunch lined up, ready to go. A lot more adventures coming up. Got a big trip coming up. Well, got a trip coming up to Israel. And hopefully it happens. And if it does, I'm gonna be taking all of this stuff with me, trying to find some cool things going on in Israel. So if you know anybody, or if you have any suggestions on places for me to go, flying into Tel Aviv, please reach out. You can find all my information, all that stuff on nevintaylorcooks.com, and send me an email or reach out to me on Twitter or Instagram or whatever. Anyway, oh, and on the video this week, we have a update from Matteo Campesino from a couple episodes ago. He was talking. I asked him about, he's in Peru right now, and I asked him about what his favorite dish was when he gets there. What's the thing that he wants to get first thing when he lands? And he said this dish called pilta capre, or something like that. I probably just butchered it, but it's like smashed avocados and yuca. And he sent a video from Peru showing us what it is in the market. So check out the video this week, because he's going to be on there too, so you can see Matteo and see the food in Peru that he was talking about. Super cool. Thank you, Matteo, in Peru. You know, if you're listening to this, thanks for sending that along. Super cool. Everything's working out very well. I love life. I love cooking. I love food and meeting all these cool people. So many good interviews to come. So many more recipes to share and adventures to go on. I can't wait to share it all here. This was the 10th episode. I don't know if that's like a big deal or not, but it's a big deal to me. So that's really cool. Thank you very much for listening and supporting, and I'll catch you guys next week.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.